Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Today on Access Utah is the first of a series of programs featuring artists and engineers from across the nation. Gabriel Elkheim, Associate Professor of Computer Engineering at University of California in Santa Cruz, joins us to talk about robotics. He developed one of the first robotic lawnmowers, and in college, he designed a winged robotic catamaran that sailed around the harbor. This design is used as a model for other robotic boats around the world, including one under development by USU alum Walter Holomans that's gaining attention from leading oceanographers. Gabriel Elkheim comes from a varied background, and his career was influenced by his father.
My dad's an engineer. My dad's a civil engineer and does engineering management. And so we moved all around the third world because he was building large infrastructure projects as they needed them around the world. One of the things, if you build infrastructure, you don't live in the developed world because the developed world has all its infrastructure already. So my sister was born in Berkeley before they started out. My brother in Istanbul. I was born in Tunisia. We moved around quite a bit. It was a pipeline in Turkey. There was an airport in Tunisia. There was a flood control in Bangladesh, a bridge in Zaire, hydroelectric dam in Brazil. That's where we spent, where I spent sort of the most part. So I went to high school in Brazil. And at the end of Brazil, every college in the United States looked sort of equally close from Rio de Janeiro. And so we moved. I went back to Princeton for my undergraduate degree, and my parents moved back to California where we had been before we left. There was an interim in there, but we were in California for about 6 years. And then, so in terms of being an engineer, I don't know that there was ever much of a choice. I was always going to be some kind of engineer or other. I changed from my original thoughts were I was going to be molecular biologist or genetic engineer because, you know, playing God, always an intriguing possibility. The other one was I did some work through electrical engineering, computer science. Eventually, I wound up in aerospace engineering because I'd always loved things that fly. I'd been building airplane models as a little kid. I learned to hang glide when I was 16 in Brazil and did that for a while, which was and perhaps a more unusual high school sport, and I'm not quite convinced how I talked my parents into that one. Apparently, I demanded that I was going to learn to skydive, and they flatly refused. And then I said, well, how about hang gliding? And somehow they agreed, so I picked that up. After my undergraduate work, I went to work for a French oil field services company, Schlumberger, and I worked up and down the west coast of Africa. So I started in France, then Algeria, then Italy, then back to Algeria, then Nigeria, and then a few other places up and down the west coast before eventually deciding that was enough. And I started graduate work in Israel for a year at the Technion up in Haifa. I spent about a year there in the aeronautics faculty. And then from there, after about a year, I came back to California and continued my graduate work at Stanford, where I did my master's and PhD in aeronautics and astronautics, which is what Stanford, MIT, and Caltech call aerospace engineering for some strange reason. there's an interesting story behind that, I'm sure.
This is when Elkheim decided he wanted a career in academics. For his PhD thesis, he built a boat that sailed itself.
And the basic idea behind it is not different than the basic ideas behind robotics in general, which is, I like to call them the 3 Ds, dull, dirty, or dangerous, the places you want to send a machine rather than send a person. I'll add a 4th D to that, which is dear. Sometimes it's very expensive to do it, and it's just a lot cheaper if you can automate it. And that interest to sort of, it kind of blossomed through graduate work. I started doing a lot more embedded electronics, a lot more actively controlled devices. Eventually, sort of, I built the sailboat. After graduating with my PhD in 2002, I worked for a small company in Redondo Beach, California, that was building a robotic lawnmower that obviously you can't go out and buy it today, so it didn't quite make it, although there were some really interesting technical challenges to it, which we're fairly clever about solving. The thing that eventually stopped us was the lawnmower manufacturer was horrified at the potential liability of having a robotic lawnmower with a spinning blade on it that they couldn't necessarily stop. It turns out that if you run over your own foot with a lawnmower, well, you were pushing it. It's your fault, not theirs. When it's a robot, it becomes entirely unresolved question of who exactly is responsible or, in the legal sense, liable. And so that stopped us on a number of occasions.
Elkheim's PhD work started with aircraft. He designed GPS programs that allowed airplanes to land blind.
So the so-called Category 3 zero-zero problem. So the wheels touch down when the pilot begins to see the runway. I worked with a whole gaggle of other very bright grad students at Stanford developing that. And in the end, we all went down and yanked one of United 737s off the line and did 104 automated landings, of which 103 worked, and the 104th did not. During that one flight, one of the GPS satellites blinked for exactly 1 millisecond, for 1,000th of a second. And we happened to be on final approach when that happened. The system caught it. It said, I no longer have adequate information to land. It put the red light on, sounded the horn, told the pilot to go around and try again. And it turns out the pilots were actually more interested in the failure than they were in the successes. They were quite impressed that it caught that blink. It took us a number of years going back and forth with the Air Force to convince them that their satellite had in fact blinked. They told us our satellites don't blink. And we told them we have it. We have it on data. We can show you the trace. Eventually from that, I went to automating tractors, farm tractors, and then from there to the sailboat. And then I joined the faculty here in 2003. Here I'm in the computer engineering department as opposed to the aerospace engineering department. We don't have an aerospace engineering department here. And the computer engineering department, at least here at Santa Cruz, is sort of where I like to say it's where we experiment. We try different things. We've grown this into a full undergraduate degree in robotics engineering, which exists at WPI here and a handful of other places, but not many. And we have our first freshman cohort started this year. And we've got 14 eager young ones and a couple of transfer students who are older. And I suspect that that's going to grow in popularity. Within that, I teach one of the sort of center courses to that is it's the Introduction to Mechatronics. It's how to build a robot in 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And mostly it's how not to sleep during those 10 weeks. It's a very intense class. It starts out very basic and it ramps up very, very quickly. And it's a lot of fun and dull.
What kind of robots?
For the class, the robots are all, they're very small little wheeled robots that run on a field and generally shoot ping pong balls at things. That's within the capability of what the students can build within 10 weeks.
Okay.
So we give them a lot of electronics, a lot of software, a lot of things pre-solved for them, but they still have to do the design, the integration, the testing, get everything to work. There's a lot of things that happen that they don't expect. Most of the difficulty is in debugging. So at first you say, and we try to make the themes every year relatively light and amusing. So last year it was a pirate theme. So their robot had to start on their island, get to the enemy island, get back to their island, shoot ping pong balls at the enemy ship, stay within the channel and not go off into the water, not go off the water into land. So that was I've done one of my personal favorites was we did the good, the bad, and the slugly. So the robots start back to back, take 10 paces, turn around, try to fire a tin can off of each other's heads with ping pong balls. That was an equally fun one. And the students come up sometimes with innovative designs and things like that. Everyone is different. It's a very open-ended problem. They don't know generally, they don't know what they're going to be working on until about 5 weeks before the end. I have some good ideas for next year's one, but I won't share them in case it gets out. I try to find sort of some – everything has a slug in the title, and there's a because that's our mascot.
Okay.
And they're a lot of fun, but they're a little crazy.
And what areas do you see are going to be the most important uses for robots, and what niches do you see them filling?
So this is sort of an interesting question of where are robots going into the future? So one of the things we know is robots are currently incredibly successful in the factory automation type environment. However, one of the things you'll notice if you do that, if you ever sort of go in and look at one, is that the humans and the robots are very segregated from each other. These curtains or walls or black and white stripes on the ground to tell the humans where not to stand. And the reason for this is that the robots move very quickly and with a lot of force behind them, such that they will very easily kill a human who happens to walk in the path. They are programmed in such a way they don't even know whether the human is there or not. They simply move the same repetitive task over and over again. That's what we've done. We're very good at it. It's had a wonderful economic gains in terms of productivity, and we can get beautifully manufactured objects for much less than we ever had to pay for them before, and that's sort of a wonderful thing. However, we haven't had much success with getting robots to interact with people in a normal environment. Right? So this is where I see a lot of the interesting research in going. So for instance, and I can name literally thousands of applications, but I'll give you one off the top of the bat that's very pressing, is the elder care scenario. So a lot of us have aging parents. Our parents are getting more and more infirm as people have fewer children. There's less, you don't just move in with your son or daughter anymore like you used to. That's no longer as socially acceptable. And there's a huge need to keep an eye on the elderly parent, help them with some menial tasks, monitor them to know that everything is going okay. So think about for a moment the relationship you would have with an elderly parent or other relative who lived next door to you. You could look, check in on them every day. Did they pick up the newspaper? Have a chat with them every now and then? Are they confused? Are they not? All of this allows them to retain their independence for longer, which is obviously a nice thing. It's a much less expensive thing if someone can take care of themselves than if you have to put them in a nursing home or some other kind of thing. And it's a much higher quality of life if they can take care of themselves. So part of the question is, how can we extend that duration that they can take care of themselves and live independently without putting a burden on the caretaker? Because there's lots of sort of work on how much of a burden it is to take care of an elderly parent and things like you can't, if they're even moderately healthy but not fully healthy, it can just kill your own productivity. You can no longer keep a full-time job because you have to – it's sort of like having a small child, right? I'll accept that, you know, without them growing up and to be less dependent, they're just going to get worse and worse. And so we actually are developing some things in-house for ways to monitor the elderly and help them out. We have a robot we want to build and put in the house with them that will interact with them in a way that is acceptable to elderly patients. And I think we have 5 canonical tasks that we want to test. One is just some compliance monitoring to see whether or not they are taking the medications that they're supposed to take at the time that they're supposed to take them. One is to sort of help them out of a chair and just sort of reach out and make sure that they can stand, bring them the glass of water or find the remote for them, things like that. So there's a few little sort of key tasks turn into sort of an appliance type device where sort of think of it as Skyping to their daughter or son and saying, well, can you come over, managing their schedule, simple things like that. This is a really big problem space. There's huge things here. The same infrastructure that we've come up with is useful far beyond the elder care scenario. It's actually useful for almost any small home business environment and things of that nature. It could be, you can imagine, for instance, a 7-Eleven having a robot inside that monitors, you know, after the store closes, it goes along, takes a look at the inventory on all the shelves, goes into the back, pulls everything out, and restacks them neatly on the shelf, cleans things up. These are all things that are currently done by a human. They're not particularly, you know, efficient. It's not a particularly glorious job, and it's one of those things that's kind of stultifyingly dull, and it's one of those things that, again, we can replace a human with. And I think this can go vastly farther. I think the next big generation of push in robotics is going to be robots that interact with humans at a very intimate level. So no longer things that are simply building devices for us, but things that are actually... So NSF likes to call this the co-robotics, where the robot is working along with you and cooperating with you as opposed to simply being a specialized machine that does a certain action repeatedly.
Next, he explains what's so interesting about robot boats, like the one USU alum Walter Holmans is designing to survey the oceans worldwide.
So autonomous ocean surface vessels of any kind, these are things that can sail, swim, propel themselves upon the surface of the ocean for autonomous data gathering. That is, they can gather data by themselves. There is a huge cost to putting a research vessel out at sea with all the researchers on it, getting all the data. numbers anywhere from sort of $3,000 to $5,000 an hour are sort of tossed about in terms of ocean vessels that can go out and do this kind of oceanographic monitoring. These are expensive. These are expensive assets. Because they're expensive assets, you only do science with them when that cost is justified. And so, for instance, you load up all the researchers on, you go out for 3 weeks at a time, you do all of this stuff together and wherever the boat happens to go, and then you come back and you crunch the data and you decide what this tells you. Because the cost is so high, so for instance, here in Santa Cruz, we have two particular things happen that are of great interest to the oceanographers. One is when the first heavy rainfall occurs, we've got this big giant watershed here that drains into the Monterey Bay. And while it drains into the Monterey Bay, you get very nutrient-rich fresh water because it's running off all the hills and getting all the rotted vegetable material and dead animals and garbage and everything else, and it washes it out the rivers to sea. So you've got fresh water that's got a lot of nutrients in it floating on top of salt water, and they're mixing as it goes out. What we currently don't know, we don't know the boundaries of the mixing. We don't know how far it goes out. We don't know how fast it mixes. We know that there's a huge amount of plankton life and marine life that occurs at the edges of that transition, but we have no idea, you know, does it last a day? Does it last an hour? Does it last a week? We don't know. We have here in Santa Cruz in the Monterey Bay, there are two buoys that are out in the direction of the ocean. And so we get two spot measurements of the flow that goes past those two buoys, but that's it. We have no idea of the horizontal extent. We don't know how far the tongue goes out. We just know it passes the second buoy, which is, I think, 3 miles out. That's it. So this is a great application where we'd love to study this more. We want to study it at temporal scales that are rapid. That is to say, we can see how it evolves in time. We want to see it at high fidelity spatially. So we want to get the boundaries of it and sort of map it as it's occurring. Except, and we could do this with one of the big ships. The only problem is no one knows ahead of time when the first heavy rainfall is going to be. And generally it's at night and the weather's usually bad and the crew doesn't want to go out anyway. But you have to reserve the ship. And that means you have to pay for the ship to stand by ready to go at a moment's notice at the first prediction of rain. This is hard. This is expensive. And so this can, you know, if you're wrong, you've blown your entire research budget holding for 3 weeks waiting for the rain to come. Right, and this is tragic, right? These are hard fought for resources. We don't have a lot of them, and so getting this kind of data is really interesting to the scientists. It's interesting for our understanding of the oceans, and especially the littoral areas, the areas between the coast and the deep water ocean, is where much of the sort of drivers of what happens on land with the interaction between ocean water and land life. All of this happens in relatively shallow near water, as far as we know, and we have no idea exactly what's going on because the data is just too expensive to get. So if we can figure out a way to automate gathering of that data, then all of a sudden I have a different way of looking at it, and I can have a robotic boat waiting at the dock, ready to dispatch. And as soon as the rainfall starts, off it goes, and it starts gathering data. From the comfort of my office, I can see that data in real time on a screen. I can decide that this area is interesting. I can retask the robot to go look at this area. So the kind of boat that Walter is building, it's a I'll say it's an evolutionary design from the one I developed as my PhD. He's got some areas he's gone a little different than where I went, but it has a potential for being low cost, very long endurance for, you know, days, months, weeks, perhaps even months out at a time. I won't go as far as years, not yet, until we've got months under our belt to sort of show that it'll work. But that can really dramatically reduce the cost and the difficulty in acquiring the data that we want to get. And this has huge implications all around, because currently a lot of what we do is kind of guessing in the dark. We've got satellite measurements, and they're good for sort of large-scale phenomena. But for sort of the small scale of what happens where we really sort of get an idea of what's going on, we've got no idea. As another sort of example, one of the other things we get occasionally are what are called the harmful algal blooms, where for reasons that are unknown, the algae starts multiplying very, very fast. It sucks all of the oxygen out of the water underneath it, which turns out kills all the fish underneath it. And they get big, they bloom very fast, and then they die out and they disappear. And again, we know they happen. We can see them from the satellite data, but the fine granularity of how they evolve, where they're going, what kicks them off, what makes them die, we have no idea. Right? So far, we haven't been lucky enough to have a research vessel out when one occurs in a nearby place that we can go take a look. And even then, you would be limited in the kind of data you can get. So one of the things we're trying to get, ubiquitous, low-cost data. So my research in many ways is all about trying to change the dollar-to-data ratio. Right? So I'm trying to drop the cost of getting data. And when I mean cost, I mean that in a larger sense, not just how much money does it cost, but how much time it takes, difficulty, inconvenience, things like that. The more easy we can make the data acquisition, the more useful it will be.
That was Robotic Lawnmower and Robot Boat pioneer Gabriel Elkheim talking about the future uses of robotics. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. You can catch me in my spaceship, I shoot your minds. I'm independent, now I'm constantly reach for stars. I'm holding you, I wanna see you see tonight. Every day you know I keep it moving on the line. No, don't kill me, just make me harder. I won't drown in my sorrow, keep my head above water. But now I'm keeping doing this, I'ma keep it doing it. Now pull the track back. Sitting look at stars, claps by the mold, and I just play this thing, don't need no auto tones. I keep it moving to the people who got nothing left.
Each person received his or her own word, with the assurance that no one else would use it that way in this universe or the beyond.
Isabel Allende's Magic Words, this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday afternoon at 3 on Utah Public Radio.
Did you know that students retain content from an informational text better than they do when the information is embedded in a story? Did you know that when students are rewarded for reading across a wide range of genres of texts, it has a positive impact on their attitude toward reading? When young children are given a choice of books to receive as a gift, they often favor informational books.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn. Joining us is writer Patrick Bryden Keefe. With the drug-related violence in Mexico thriving, understanding how the drug industry operates is crucial to combating it. Keefe investigated the business side of the booming illegal drug trade, and in June 2012, his report, Cocaine Inc., was published in the New York Times Magazine. Keefe first discusses his impressive background.
I am a fellow at the Century Foundation and a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. I trained as a lawyer, actually. I went to law school, and when I was in, I was actually in law school when 9/11 happened. And I had done some graduate work before that on wiretapping by government agencies, which at the time was a very obscure subject. And after 9/11, there was much more discussion of that kind of intelligence and how we use it and how effective it is and some of the privacy and civil liberties concerns associated with wiretapping. And what I did first was expanded some of my graduate work into a book and kind of went for it. And then I started writing for magazines from there.
And then how did you get interested in writing about the drug war?
I had spent the last 5 or so years writing a lot about the way, sort of about the underground economy, the underground global economy, about the way things move illicitly from one place to another. And so I wrote a book about human smuggling called The Snakehead. But I also wrote articles about money laundering and about gun smuggling and really the way that things move clandestinely from one country to another. And drugs is obviously kind of hard to overlook in that area. And so about a year ago, I started looking pretty seriously at what I was trying to look at was the business side of the Mexican cartels. I felt like with all the violence that's been going on, people sometimes overlook how sophisticated these operations are as businesses. And so this was actually before I just recently went on staff at The New Yorker. But the piece that I wrote, the big piece that I wrote was a cover story for The New York Times Magazine over the summer about the business model of the Sinaloa cartel, which is the Sinaloa is the biggest of the Mexican drug cartels.
All right. And how long did it take you from the beginning to the end of the story? And
well, it was probably about 6 months for that article, but then I've continued to do research. So the article came out in June, so now it's probably been about 10 months because I've continued with the research. There's a show on PBS called Frontline, and I'm working with Frontline to sort of expand that article into a documentary.
What parts of Mexico did you visit and research for your article?
Well, I've been in Mexico City mainly, and then down along the border on the U.S. side, I spent some time in and around El Paso with a guy who until recently was in the cartel. I haven't gone to Sinaloa. It's funny, it's a question I get a lot, but Mexico is actually a country that is quite dangerous for journalists now. And so there are some places that I'm not a war correspondent. You know, my risk threshold is actually reasonably low. So the thing to do with the Sinaloa cartel would be to go to the state of Sinaloa, but it's a pretty dangerous place for a gringo to show up with a notebook.
Sure, I can imagine, especially when you're covering them, right?
Yes.
And how did you develop that relationship with your source from the Sinaloa?
Yeah, what I did was, I had really wanted to try and track down people who actually work in the business, and it was a long process, but what I did was I started looking at lawsuits in the United States, basically prosecutions of cartel members. I mean, the thing about the Sinaloa, this is true of a number of the cartels, but Sinaloa in particular, it's so big and so vast in terms of the amount of narcotics that it moves that it's kind of a bit of an octopus, and you have these tentacles in all kinds of American cities. And what happens is that when people get busted, there are these criminal trials. And often in the criminal trials, they'll arrest a whole bunch of people, and then they'll persuade some of them to testify against the others. And so what I did was I tracked down those lawsuits, and I found the transcripts of the trial testimony, and then I would find out where those people were who testified. And in some cases, they were locked up in state or federal prison, and I would write them letters and talk to them on the phone. And then in other instances, people had gotten out of prison. And so, for instance, this guy in El Paso was just out there, you know, having testified against the cartel. He was out there living in El Paso, and I went and visited him, spent some time with him.
Wasn't it dangerous, or isn't it dangerous for them to talk to you? And what was their incentive for talking to you?
Look, I think anybody who testifies against a drug cartel and then goes back out into the world is living a dangerous life to begin with. I think different people had different incentives for talking to me. I mean, certainly some of the people in prison were looking at very long sentences. And to be perfectly candid, I think people are lonely. You know, they like the company. And I also think that there's a very strong human instinct, even among criminals, to tell our stories. So it was kind of fun in some instances because there were these people who clearly have been very careful about and kind of secretive about what they do for years and years. But if you can kind of get them in the right mood, make them feel comfortable, they will really talk a great deal. It almost seems like a relief for them to talk.
Do they remain anonymous or probably a mix of both?
Yeah. There's one guy who I named, and then there were a couple who were anonymous. I had to be very careful because in some instances you don't use somebody's name, but if you give details about their, you know, every case is distinct, right? So if you give too many details about the case, then it's going to be obvious to people who's talking. So I think people also took some comfort in that. And again, because Sinaloa is such a huge organization, I mean, like if you look at the very lowest estimates of the size of the drug trade from Mexico into the United States, and you look at the market share of the Sinaloa cartel, by the most conservative estimates, this one organization is probably has about $3 billion a year in revenue. So it's really big, you know, like if it was a legitimate corporation, it would be really, really big. And in some ways, that's a comfort to the people talking with you, right? Because they know there's so many worker bees out there, really around the planet at this point, that if you don't use their name, it's not necessarily going to be easy to trace it back to them.
Okay. And have you had any response from the organization since your article has come out?
Yeah. So I haven't had any response from the organization proper. I did speak with somebody who I'm working on this frontline project with, who has been down in Sinaloa, and he came back and said that they have had the article translated and it has been widely read, which is sort of an interesting thing to hear. I've gotten a lot of feedback. I've gotten some feedback from the people who I interviewed, you know, the people in the drug business, who've actually been really nice about it. A couple of them complained that it was too long, which I thought was funny and probably hard to argue with. But I think they kind of liked that it took it. It sort of looked at the business as a business, because I think that some of these guys actually take quite a bit of pride in how sophisticated the network they've devised is. And so I felt like they, you know, not that I whitewashed any of the violence or the brutality of what they do, but I feel like they felt that some credit was being given to them, that they, you know, they're not merely sadists. They are sadists who are also good businessmen.
The vegetable van with the horn that's honking like a mariachi band. In the middle of the street, people gather around. Put the dollar in the can. I wait, K on the TJ Cowboys hang around. Sleeping in the sidewalk with a Burger King crown. Never wake them up. My service to the rooster crows.
For our listeners, could you describe the scope of the problem? How many drugs are moving north? What kinds? And you said it's a $3 billion year.
I mean, you can almost tell the history of the business if you look back over the decades. Marijuana and, to a lesser extent, heroin have always been grown in certain parts of Mexico and smuggled across the border. That's sort of as old as the history of the border. You've had these two drugs produced in Mexico and then brought over into the United States. Something interesting happened in the 1980s, which was that you can't grow cocaine, you can't grow coca in Mexico. It only grows in certain places, really the Andes. And historically, what would happen is cocaine would move from Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, into the United States, really through Florida and through the Caribbean. And what happened in the 80s is that you had this huge crackdown by U.S. authorities and the Coast Guard, and this is sort of the Miami Vice period, where they really started policing the water and also the skies, because a lot of this was in planes, in the Caribbean. And that kind of law enforcement juggernaut that they threw at this problem was actually successful. But it was successful only insofar as it, people in the DEA call it the balloon effect, that you sort of squeeze one end of the balloon and then the other end gets big. So what happened is that rather than just quit and go home, the Colombians started, you know, they figured, well, If there's all this pressure preventing us from getting into Florida, why don't we just go up through Mexico overland, where you have this massive 2,000-mile border that's hard to police? And initially what happened is that they hired the Mexicans, all of the big Mexican drug cartels that we know of today. Initially they were really just kind of middlemen who were like performing a function where they were paid to take the drugs up through Mexico into the U.S. But what happened in the 90s is that they started, as they were bringing the drugs up, they started saying, look, you know, rather than pay me in cash, why don't you pay me in kind? Why don't you let me invest in a little bit of my own product? And eventually, sort of through that move, they actually became the dominant ones. So they sort of vertically integrated to some extent, getting out of the transportation business and actually into the cocaine business. And so then, you know, you had three drugs that were coming across. And then in the last 10 years or so, we've had a similar thing where when methamphetamine became a big problem across the U.S., one of the legal responses that the U.S. government took was to make it harder to obtain the precursor chemicals for meth, to make it here. This is the reason when you have a cold and you go and buy Sudafed, they ask for ID and won't let you buy too many. But that was another kind of unintended consequence, is that when it became harder to manufacture methamphetamine in this country in large quantities. The Mexican cartels, who were very entrepreneurial about this, saw an opportunity and realized, boy, we can manufacture it here just in enormous volumes and send that as well. So now the big cartels like Sinaloa are not just vertically integrated, but they're also horizontally integrated in that Sinaloa actually moves all four drugs now. A lot of marijuana, a lot of cocaine, a small amount of heroin, and increasingly a great deal of methamphetamine.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. I read in one of your articles that someone asked you about the impact of medical marijuana, and that the sources you talked to said it didn't have any impact on their business.
Right, which was surprising to me because, I mean, there are, and it becomes a really relevant issue after the election a few days ago, because we've seen these two ballot initiatives, the pass in Colorado and Washington State, actually not just for medical marijuana, but legalizing marijuana altogether. And there's a lot of speculation about what that's going to do to the cartels. Some people think it will actually really hit them in a pretty intense way in terms of their bottom line, in part because marijuana is still a big part of its – when we think of drug cartels, we often think of cocaine and hard drugs, but marijuana is a big part of their business. And it's also fairly cheap to produce, so it ends up kind of subsidizing the more expensive logistics of getting cocaine from South America up here. So there are some people who think that if we legalize marijuana in the U.S., it'll really hit them hard. And there may be some truth to that. I don't think anybody really knows. But it was interesting for me anecdotally when I asked them about the medical marijuana, you know, various measures that would make it kind of more possible for people to get kind of locally grown marijuana as opposed to Mexican marijuana. There didn't seem to have been a moment where they like felt the pinch from that in their business, which I think must just be a function of how huge the demand is in this country.
Would you say the Mexican cartel rules the drug world in the U.S.? Do they have major competitors?
They really do sort of rule the drug world. There are different – it's complicated. One of the big questions that nobody has a huge amount of clarity on is how far into local distribution they are. So how present are the cartels in the United States? And what I was able to work out through my research is that the most profit with drugs actually comes – at the level of kind of retail distribution. When you take like a wholesale, you know, 100 kilos of cocaine and you actually cut that up and start selling it in tiny little quantities to buyers, that's where the most profit accrues. And so you would think that the cartel would want to be involved in that. But that retail street dealing is also the riskiest. You know, you have a lot of people fighting for turf. You've got law enforcement making arrests. And so it turns out that most of the drug dealing that happens in the United States is actually done, a lot of it is done by gangs who aren't necessarily, you know, a phone call away from handlers in the cartel in Mexico. I think a decision was made, a very kind of business-minded decision by the cartel, that they actually don't want to be involved in street dealing. So they're very involved kind of up to the point of wholesale distribution in this country. You'll have people in, you know, from the cartel in a city like Chicago. And they're very present there, and what they do is they make sure that the drugs come in and then that they're sold to wholesale buyers, and then they collect the money. And this is something a lot of people don't think about with drug cartels. Really, only half of the business is bringing drugs into the United States. The other half is sending money back to Mexico. So they have the responsibility of bringing those drugs here, but then also the equal responsibility, which is taking all that money and getting it back. And that's the extent to which they're really involved in this country. You know, at this point, I don't think the Colombians really compare. There aren't other big organized crime groups in this particular space present much competition to the cartels. The real competition, frankly, is between one cartel and the others.
In your New York Times article, you mentioned bloody turf wars are the shards of El Padrino's organization. Can you talk about those turf wars and how they're contributing to all the violence in Mexico?
Yeah. So historically in Mexico, there had been a little bit of a tendency on the part of the ruling party, which was the ruling party for years and years and years, the PRI, to kind of turn a blind eye to the drug trade. And the thinking was essentially that, I mean, look, in some instances, this was corruption and the government was getting paid off. In other instances, I think they were just thinking, the people aren't really selling drugs in our country. They're moving it all up into the United States. It's kind of not our business. We don't want to confront these guys. So it'll be more peaceful if we leave well enough alone. And then under the presidency of Felipe Calderon, who's just finishing up his presidency now, he came into office in 2006. And in 2007, he really launched a big offensive against the cartels, really putting the pressure on them. And he did this in cooperation with the United States. I mean, we wanted him to. And the result, you know, was a couple of things. One was that there was a lot of bloodshed in terms of clashes between the government and the cartels. But then also, as the cartels felt that pressure, they really started fighting amongst themselves. And what we've seen is this incredible kind of carnage, which results from these shifting alliances and this kind of ever-evolving competition for who controls which portions of the border. Because the border, you know, the border crossings and where you can get things across are incredibly lucrative. If you control that turf, you can control anything that flows through there. And that has led to, I mean, people disagree about the numbers, but a number you often hear is about 60,000 fatalities between 2007 and now, which to me is a pretty extraordinary number because, you know, those are the kinds of numbers we see in wars. And we don't talk about the notion that there might be a war happening, a war of sorts happening in our neighbor to the south and our third largest trading partner. But I think in some ways you can make a good argument that there is.
You say you don't think the U.S. is doing enough. What do you think the second Obama administration should be doing?
Well, I think there's a lot more that we could be doing. One thing I think is just to kind of recognize the gravity of the problem. And I think it's easy in some ways for us to be insulated from that, right? Because there hasn't been a lot of what they call spillover violence into the U.S. American cities, even cities on the border, are still very safe compared to cities in Mexico. So one thing is just to kind of recognize what is happening and how grave it is. I think the next thing is to recognize that we bear some responsibility for this. Whatever you think about the drug cartels, I mean, they are selling drugs and we are buying them. And they wouldn't be in this business if they didn't happen to live next door to the biggest market for consumer narcotics in the world, which is us. So I guess I think that there are kind of pragmatic, but also, frankly, there are moral reasons why we should take this seriously and feel like it's a shared responsibility to do something about it. In terms of what we could be doing, you know, there is the Merida Initiative, which is a plan to give assistance to Mexico in this capacity. We've been a little bit slow in actually meeting some of the goals that we had in terms of getting resources to them. But I also think the Merida Initiative focuses a lot on hardware. You know, we'll give them military helicopters and things like that in order to fight the battle. Where I think a lot of what Mexico needs actually is really strong institutions. It needs a capable, not corrupt national police force and judiciary where when you arrest somebody for involvement in the drug trade, you know that they're actually going to go to trial and face real justice. Chapo Guzman, the guy who heads the Sinaloa cartel, it's sort of a national joke that he got sent away to prison and then at a certain point he just kind of walked out. And the reason that he walked out was that he knew he was about to get extradited to the United States where he might have to face some real time. So I think some of what we need to do is the kind of unglamorous, messy work of helping our counterparts in Mexico fashion a real criminal justice system that looks a little bit more like what we have here. And then inside this country, I think there's a great deal that we could do as well. I mean, I think that I mentioned earlier that we always think about the drugs moving north and not the money moving south. I think we could do much, much more to figure out the money of the cartels and how American dollars are going to the cartels. This is not an area that we have really resourced all that aggressively. If you go to any border crossing with Mexico, you'll see that there's a huge line of cars from Mexico heading into the United States and a very quick line from the United States into Mexico. And part of the reason for that is that most of our border checks are looking at things coming into the country, not things going out of the country. I don't mean to suggest that you would have anything like a one-to-one parity, but you could do a lot more going southbound than we do. And then finally, I think we really do need to think seriously about what the implications of legalization of marijuana might be for the cartels. And in some ways, the upshot of these two initiatives, successful initiatives in Washington and Colorado, is that we sort of have a laboratory in which to try and study that now. I will tell you that in Mexico, you know, where everybody knows that a big part of what the cartels do is move marijuana, which right now it's illegal in Mexico to move marijuana into the United States, and the government, you know, expends a lot of blood and treasure going after people for doing that. They look at those initiatives and they say, hey, wait a second, do we really, like, how many more lives do we want to lose trying to stop people in Mexico from moving this drug into the United States, which is now legal in two states in the U.S.? So I think that's going to be a tricky conversation we need to have with Mexico, and one that, you know, it'll be a negotiation, something we need to work out. But Obama is actually meeting with the new president, Peña Nieto, so he'll have the opportunity to start that conversation.
In your story, you also reveal the involvement of U.S. banks in the Mexican drug war, and also that the guns the cartel use, many of them, are from the U.S.
Right. I mean, these are two other elements, both of which are tricky for different reasons. So, you know, one question, which is a really tricky one to answer, is, say you have a cartel like the Sinaloa cartel. Say they have $3 billion a year in revenue. Not all of that money is in cash. Some of that money finds its way into the illicit banking system. And we've had some indications that big multinational banks are actually really involved with laundering this money. Wachovia, I mean, it was actually Wells Fargo at the time, but since been bought by Wachovia, was implicated a couple of years ago in a massive case where there were hundreds of millions of dollars coming from suspect sources in Mexico that ended up essentially getting laundered through the bank. There was just recently a big Senate investigation of HSBC, and there are multiple criminal investigations in different jurisdictions across the U.S. of HSBC, also for essentially turning a blind eye or not having appropriate checks on cartel money. This is an area where I think we could be doing much more. I think we cannot have a scenario in which our banks engage in that kind of activity and essentially get like a fine, which is what they get. I mean, they get a slap on the wrist. I think that that, you know, there's a variety of steps we could take, but that's an area I think we want to crack down on much more. And then there's the guns issue, which is a really tricky one and very controversial in this country. It was controversial even before the Fast and Furious debacle. But there are, I forget the number, it's something like 5,000 gun stores within 50 miles of the Mexican border. And it's effectively impossible to legally purchase a gun in Mexico. So, you know, people disagree about the precise numbers, but, you know, the great majority of the guns that are being used in the violence in Mexico do seem to trace back to the United States. And I think that should occasion some real reflection on our part. And we should be thinking as creatively and aggressively as we can about trying to prevent that flow of guns going down there. I mean, I hasten to say, not so creatively as they were thinking in Fast and Furious, where they kind of went too far and clearly made a great mistake. But I do think it's an issue we need to address.
In the process of all your work, research, and interviews, what did you learn, and how did it change your view of corruption, underground economies, and the drug world?
Boy, many, many ways. I mean, I'll give you one example. One thing that really knocked me out is in talking to people who've been involved in the cartels, you know, what they'll tell you is that the cartels control different border crossings, right? So like Tijuana was a border crossing that was really fought over because it was very lucrative. And eventually the Sinaloa cartel took control of it. And what that means is that only the Sinaloa cartel can move money down through that crossing, and only the Sinaloa cartel can move drugs up north through it. And all the other cartels know this. And so you wouldn't really take the risk if you were, you know, part of the Zetas or the Gulf Cartel or the Knights Templar or one of these other organizations. You wouldn't take the risk of trying to send money down or drugs up north through a stretch of border that you didn't control. And it's funny, it took me the longest time to actually figure out the implications of that, because it seems kind of obvious, right? But what that means is that the cartels have actually succeeded in doing what the United States and Mexico through all our history have not been able to do, which is control the border. You know, the cartels actually have enough control and enough insight and kind of vision into what's going on there that they're able to say, okay, you can go through, but you cannot go through. And obviously they have advantages we don't, right? Because it's like, if you get caught, we'll kill you, not just throw you in jail or deport you. But it was kind of stunning to me to think about the idea that they've actually come up with a way of policing the border that is in some respects much more effective and successful than anything we've managed to come up with in several hundred years.
Everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting.
These guys are very, very sophisticated, and I think in some ways the kind of mayhem and the sadism, which is horrible, can sometimes distract from how sophisticated they are. So I just think it would be a great mistake to underestimate them, which I think we sometimes do. Because we just think, you know, these are crazy people. They're cutting each other's heads off and putting it on YouTube. How clever could they be? But in fact, there's a lot of ingenuity to the way they approach these problems. And I think that, you know, in some ways we need to, the one thing we can learn from them in a kind of generic sense is that we need to try and find some of our own ingenuity too.
That was writer Patrick Redden-Keefe. Sherry Quinn for Science Questions. Thanks for listening.
Mouthwash, jukebox, gasoline. Pistols are pointing at a poor man's pockets. Smiling eyes ripping out of his sockets. Got a devil's haircut.